Blog Talk Radio.
This is Amanda.
And today we're doing our show on anxiety and the different effects and causes and different ways to cope with it. I feel like this is a really important show to do for college students that might be facing anxiety or depression or any of these types of issues. And this is for mild anxiety and depression that most of us cope with around stress time and or test time and when the semester gets to be a little hectic.
True that.
I think there's a lot of negative stigma surrounding it, and so, you know, it's time to get it out in the open. You guys have anything to say about that?
Yeah. I think it's something we all deal with, and especially with school.
Yeah, and I'd just like to reiterate that we're focusing on mild depression, so it's actually coping with not necessarily a chemical imbalance in the brain, but interacting with the world around you and how things are internalized and how that reflects your feelings of either anxiety and depression about the world around you.
And we're going to be having Amanda Benaroach call in. She's a psychology student at University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and she'll be giving us some background and some useful information.
And we encourage any of you listeners to call in if you have any stories or comments or responses or questions you have.
And one of the things that I think is important in both battling depression and anxiety and also a cause of it, kind of this double-edged sword, personal relationships with your professors, friends. And the reason that I say that is because it's good to have people on your side who are, you know, good critics of you, as well as being there to support you in whatever trials you're going through. And also it becomes a difficult thing when anxiety and depression is formed because your perception of how others perceive you is negative. And I think overcoming that negative perception of what people think of you is a big part of social relationships. You guys have anything to add about that?
Yeah, I think that kind of brings us back to some of our previous shows where we talked about procrastination and self-esteem. I think that depression and anxiety directly relate to procrastination and self-esteem. So if you've been listening before, you've heard us talk about those things. And very relevant in college students.
And another thing that it's kind of a strange connection to make, but if you watch the Dog Whisperer with, I believe his name is Cesar Millan, but he talks about how it's more about training the people to interact with the dogs than it is the dogs with the people. And he talks about the energy that people give off when they're dealing with a dog. And I just think that it's so relevant to interacting with humans as well. The energy you go into a situation with oftentimes will reflect your perception and perhaps other people's perceptions of you. There's this one professor I have, not to name specifically, but he and I, it's always this weird dynamic when I go in there, and I think I've kind of had this destructive energy when I go in there because I feel going in there that it's going to be awkward and we're going to have this experience that isn't as fulfilling, and sure enough, that's exactly what happens, and I just I know how then all of a sudden it's when I'm in class, like, you know, I think about his perception of me, and then I think, like, what does he think I'm actually thinking of him? Mm-hmm. And it turns into this this level of anxiety. And I really think that it's all because of my perception. Had I perceived things differently, come in with a different energy, things would have been differently.
It looks like we have a caller. Is this Amanda?
Oh.
Hey, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I am Amanda Benaroach. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota, and I am looking to graduate with a degree in psychology. So they have a fabulous program there. So.
Awesome. Do you want to tell us why you got interested in psychology in the first place?
Sure. Well, I'm kind of a people person, and it's just always been really interesting to me to see what makes people tick and just, like, different motivations people have and interpersonal relationships. So I like people watching, basically. So why not get paid?
Well, do you want to tell us a little bit about depression from the clinical view, I guess?
As it relates to college students, I can, or just kind of in general. Well, depression affects, like, within a year, up to 10% of the population, and then, like, over one's entire lifetime, women, I guess, are more prone to it than men. For women, it's, like, 10 to 25% will suffer from some sort of depressive episode in their life, and for men, like, about 10%. So it's super common, even though there's kind of a stigma against it, I guess. And there are a lot of different kind of symptoms of it. It can manifest itself, like, physically, like you can just be really tired and just not feel quite up to doing the things you used to do, or you can feel just, like, kind of uninspired, I mean, as far as emotions go, and, like, nothing you do matters. I think a sense of hopelessness is a phrase that's pretty commonly used to describe it, and it's basically all that you've heard about it.
Did the statistics you mentioned reflect just the American the state's society or the world at large?
Yeah, those were U.S. statistics, but I know it's pretty common worldwide. Similar statistics across Europe, I think. Different scales of measurement, actually, across countries. It's really interesting to look at the differences in rates, so I don't have any specifics on that.
Okay. Do you want to explain anxiety briefly?
Sure. Anxiety, I think we've all seen this in people, is just kind of a sense of impending doom and wanting to do all that you can to kind of protect yourself from whatever you think it might be that's a threat. And it's kind of seen in, like, the fight or flight response. I don't know if you guys know what I mean, but, like, when an animal feels threatened, it'll kind of get really defensive and kind of freeze up, and it's that same type of thing. So oftentimes people with depression will also have anxiety. So.
Okay. I looked it up online also. According to Mayo Clinic, depression is exaggerated stress. So you just feel like the littlest thing is a lot more stressful than it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
Oftentimes, yeah. It really depends on the person and also the severity of the depression, because, you know, for really severe cases of depression, oftentimes people don't even let anything bother them. You know, they're just emotionally shut off. So it really varies.
I just had a quick question about the statistics for depression. Now, I don't know if I missed what you said, but was that just for people that experience any level of depression, or was that specifically severe depression that may require some sort of medical treatment?
Well, it's any sort of depression, so it's like bipolar disorder is included in that, or dysthymia, which is kind of a low-level, long-lasting depression. And I don't know. And hearing some feedback. Am I the only one who's hearing that?
Yeah, we're hearing that too.
Okay.
Not really sure why.
Yeah, well, it just got better, so sorry about that. So, yeah, it can either be, like, bipolar disorder, because that's fluctuations of manic and depressive states, or it also includes dysthymia, which is, like, a low-level, long-lasting, kind of omnipresent depression, or there's, you know, even depressive disorder, depressive episodes. So like after the death of a loved one or something, there will be about 6 months of grief, or at least typically. So that includes all that.
Okay.
So within a year, about 10% of the population is affected, but within one person's lifetime, on average, that can affect between like 10 to 25% of women and like 5 to 10% of men. So.
I'm kind of curious, do you have any thoughts on why women would be more afflicted by depression than men?
Well, for the most part, they have more sensitive limbic systems. The limbic system is kind of the emotional center of the brain. And if you just look in terms of, like, development and, like, reactivity to different neurotransmitters, I know the word neurotransmitter is kind of thrown around a lot in kind of pop medicine, but it's legitimate, so... But I don't know. Also, since there's kind of a stigma against male depression, or I don't know, you know, it's kind of women are seen in culture. It's more acceptable for them to be kind of frail emotionally. So, you know, it may be just as common in men, but they may go in to get it diagnosed less frequently. There's no way to know.
Do you know if there's like an evolutionary explanation for the reason that women are a little more sensitive in the limbic system?
Yeah. Arguably, yeah, just because women needed to be more maternal. Not that they're any less strong than men, you know, or any less capable of physical labor, but, you know, men were kind of built. It was their position to be the laborers, the breadwinners and such. So the women really needed to maintain that connection with their kids and with other ladies in the tribe, I guess.
Cool. So what is the limbic system?
The limbic system is like the emotional circuit of the brain. So that features things like the amygdala, which is a little organ that processes threats. So it and the hippocampus, little parts of the brain, see something that could potentially be a threat, and then they evaluate it. And if they determine that it is indeed a threat, then it releases stress hormones like cortisol and things like that. So it's really interesting, biological psychology. We should all look into it.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any remedies that are studied besides actual medicine to help with depression and anxiety?
Well, yeah, aside from medications, which are really quite effective, there are a lot of different types of therapy, which across tons of different meta-analyses, like big studies, therapy and medications have proven about equally effective. So it comes down to convenience, basically, for deciding between the two. But I guess if it's a low level of depression or just kind of temporary, like if it just came on really suddenly for no apparent reason, anything as simple as increased physical activity or getting enough sleep, you know, really just taking care of your body, because oftentimes it's just, you know, healthy body, healthy mind type thing. But beyond that, yeah, like psychotherapy is right for a lot of people, or cognitive behavioral therapy. It really depends on how you think. So.
Okay. Can you explain maybe some of the effects of depression and anxiety in college students specifically?
Sure. Well, it's pretty really common, actually, for college students to come down with depression, be it like low level or really severe, really immediate, just because it's such a huge change in environment and try to cope with everything. So as I mentioned about the limbic system, everything is being perceived as a threat. So that's why you see a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. So effects of that can like be seen in schoolwork. You know, a lot of kids just don't feel like they could handle it. So they don't go to class. Obviously, that's not the only reason for not going to class sometimes, but, you know, not going to class, just feeling a lack of motivation overall. And because at our age, you know, late teens, early 20s, the brain, the frontal lobe, which is also kind of a big part in, like, emotions, is doing its last stages of development. So we're kind of figuring out, you know, not only who we are, but, I don't know, how we think. So that development coupled with, like, a drastic change in environment can really, I don't know, throw you off guard. So, and also social life obviously affected, just Yeah.
Well, you mentioned how we think and cognitive behavioral therapy. Can you kind of explain that?
Sure. Cognitive behavioral therapy, basically there's the patient and the normally a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and you just kind of talk through things. And cognitive behavioral, that is a combination of looking at how you think in certain situations and then changing the behavior that often goes along with it. So, you know, oftentimes the doctor will talk to the patient and say, well, the stereotypical, so how does that make you feel? And then once they picked out how they feel, they say, well, why do you feel that way? And it's a very logical kind of linear approach. And a lot of friends of mine who don't think that way have tried cognitive behavioral therapy, and it doesn't work for them because that's not how they think. But, you know, a more kind of linear thinking person would really take well to cognitive behavioral therapy. Psychotherapy, on the other hand, is kind of more abstract, looking at various causes. I mean, that's, you know, the Freudian thing, like, tell me about your mother, what about your childhood, et cetera. So.
All right, well, cognitive behavior. One of our listeners wants to know about cognitive.
So it seems like cognitive behavioral therapy then, like, would be like saying, okay, so I internalize when I go to take a test that it's going to be, I'm going to be really, really scared when I'm there. And then I have this response of where I can't think clearly. So, like, that it's kind of training the mind to move beyond the way that it's internalized.
Yeah, beyond that initial reaction, because oftentimes depressed patients have illogical or irrational thoughts, and they realize that, but they don't, you know, do anything about that. It's like, oh, well, I just feel this way, you know, but if you can get the logical, intelligent part of them to realize that their response isn't necessarily valid, you know, then they can say, oh, okay, I see. You know, it's a way of gaining insight, which is really what most types of psychological therapy is about, kind of understanding why you do something, why you shouldn't or don't necessarily need to, and then trying to, you know, work on changing your behaviors accordingly.
Okay, so changing your behaviors, your way of thinking, this is all just cultivating new habits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I guess this kind of leads us into a podcast that a couple of us listened to about mindfulness. And I know Amanda, not you, but the other Amanda, you listened to that. And do you want to explain that to us a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Basically, this podcast was just talking about the practice of meditation mindfulness. And Amanda, have you ever heard about mindfulness meditation?
I have, yeah.
You have?
You want me to kind of talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, maybe you can just explain to our listeners what
sure.
I mean by that.
Yeah. Well, mindfulness is also a cognitive-based approach to the treatment of depression, and it's actually based on Buddhist principles of, like, concentrated awareness of one's thought and, like, most deeply rooted in the belief that an understanding of oneself is essential, you know, on the path to overall enlightenment. So it's basically really trying to focus in on, you know, getting in touch with how one really feels and really thinks and stuff, and it's really effective for, again, people who are able to grasp it.
Right. And, you know, since we are sort of focused on, like, the typical college student, you know, we can, you know, make a general claim that, you know, most college students probably aren't experiencing that really severe depression that may require, like, use of, you know, medicine or whatever, but maybe that, you know, it is more of a depression that sort of arises just from, you know, maybe like your mental state, you know,
right.
Like the habits that you've cultivated and, you know, the effect that it has on your overall mental well-being. And, you know, basically in this podcast, they were talking about you know, using a tactic like mindfulness meditation to sort of, you know, like you were, like you explained so well, like creating awareness, like focusing your attention and sort of bringing your mental life sort of into perspective, really. And just sort of using that practice to sort of take, you know, a few minutes every day, or, you know, some people spend like a half an hour to an hour where they just sort of, they sort of meditate and sort of just bring their internal mental life, you know, just sort of meditate on it and, you know, just to kind of bring their mental awareness more focused.
Right, and so, I think that's part of what makes it so effective. You know, the people who are able to kind of think abstractly enough to get past, you know, the fact that it's just based on kind of internal therapy are able to really kind of take their emotions, you know, and these causes for their, you know, feeling depressed. It really takes them out of the shadows, you know, and puts them into light and, like you said, puts them into perspective. So it's easier to handle, you know, because if you feel like for whatever reason – you don't know why you're feeling the way you are, it's a lot harder to feel in control of yourself. So I think it's
definitely
really helpful.
And I would just like to, you know, pose this question. With that said, and if, you know, the kind of depression that we're talking about, this, like, more mild form of depression, you know, to what extent is the individual responsible for, you know, his or her own depression? I mean, obviously, you know, it is definitely related to our mental life. And, you know, maybe if we have poor, you know, habits of thought, if you will, or, you know, maybe if we're not engaging in, like, you know, positive self-talk or whatever, you know, maybe it's like those bad habits that, you know, maybe, I don't know, ultimately lead to depressive states. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point and a really, you know, a common one because it's so applicable. It, again, there are, even for mild, low-level college depression, you know, or depression that you see oftentimes in college students, it's still not necessarily that they're just not thinking positively. You know, I mean, they're, I know you say, like you hear about chemical imbalances in the brain, but oftentimes that is valid. But that's not to say that, you know, trying to put one's actions and thoughts into perspective isn't valid. Like, that's always really important. But, yeah, I mean, to a great extent, it just depends on how you, how much you try to deal with your situation, you know, your environment, and not just be a victim of it. So.
And go ahead.
Well, I was actually, I just thought I would make read this quote out of an article that I found on a Psychology Today blog, which is actually a very good resource. And if anybody listened to our previous episode on, it was a couple episodes ago about procrastination, we talked about Psychology Today and Dr. Tim Pidgeot, who, you know, he does write for this blog. But anyway, the article that this quote is from, you know, and this gets away from the college perspective a little bit, but not a lot. The title of this article was The Psychological Effects of Economic Downturn. And this sort of addressed, you know, how people are sort of feeling now that the economy has changed so much. And, you know, people are obviously losing their jobs. And, you know, I'm sure this affects college students, you know, as well. And, you know, basically the author of this just kind of addressed those specific issues. But there is a short couple of sentences that really I thought were very, very powerful and I think applicable to anybody that may be experiencing negative, depressive thoughts or mental states or whatever. And I just thought I would just read it really quickly and see if that, you know, what anybody else thought about it.
Sure.
Okay, so he talks about change, how it always provides us with an opportunity and it is not an obstacle. He goes on to say, we can also choose not to live in fear and not let the momentary influences that surround us change who we are and how we behave. Pain, whether emotional or physical, has the effect of causing us to act out of character. This gauntlet that we are all facing is a time for increasing our self-awareness, attending to the things that feed us rather than bleed us, for taking stock and taking responsibility for our own personal universe. End quote. But I just thought that was so powerful. And, you know, obviously he's addressing the state of the economy and, you know, the fact that, you know, people are experiencing, you know, maybe some sort of a depressive state. And I just thought that, you know, the way he summed that up was just, it really puts things into perspective. Does anybody want to comment on that?
That was a cool quote.
Yeah, that was really good. And I think it's important to realize that the state of the world and the economy can have a really big impact on young people, especially. We're faced with all these negative images and all these horrible stories, and, you know, we're at the very beginning of everything. You know, we're about to leave college and go off into, like, the real world, and that's a really scary thought for a lot of college students, I think, especially with the state of things today. So, I mean, that
yeah,
is a factor in depression symptoms.
Yeah, definitely change. I mean, it seems like change is always sort of been described as a stressor on the body, and anytime you have, like, you know, multiple stressors, which obviously typical college students are experiencing multiple stressors. You know, Emily, you kind of talked about that a little bit at the beginning, you know. And, you know, basically what he's saying is, like, change, you know, just change how you're thinking about it, you know. Instead of looking at something as an obstacle, look at it as an opportunity. And it just goes back to, you know, everything that we're talking about as far as, like, your mental life and how you approach it, and as far as, like, meditation, mindfulness, like, the bringing about of your own self-awareness, mm-hmm. and, you know, the effect that it has on you, that you can sort of turn around those negative states, you know? You
yeah.
can sort of take measures into your own hands, so to speak.
I think there's also a problem we haven't necessarily addressed, so I'm going to take a turn for negative town real quick. But the last line in that quote, I believe, was something along the lines of taking personal responsibility for your own universe. And I think you kind of can get what he means by that. But the lack of people taking responsibility for their own universe is apparent, and I think that a lot of people that I see use drugs like Adderall, which I wanted to ask Amanda Baranek about if she has any I don't know how to pronounce her last name, sorry, but about you know, the kind of psycho drugs that are used to enhance, I guess, the mind, and it seems like there's almost this denial of self-responsibility and self-awareness, I guess.
Well, yeah, the first thing I thought of actually when, I'm not sure if it was Emily who first mentioned the economy and the effect that that has on, you know, students and everyone in the world, but I think what that does, just kind of on a side note, is that it puts the control outside of the individual, and that kind of ties into what you were saying, you know, because, oh, I don't know, it locus of control is referenced a lot in psychology, and when people feel out of control, they feel more just subject to the whims of their emotions, and they feel like there's nothing they can do to feel better. So it's kind of that same type of thing. We're not really being encouraged to take matters into our own hands. But that quote, I mean, obviously counters what I just said.
Yeah, I mean, I just personally thought it was so powerful. And, you know, the way that he addresses the fact that certain things are out of our control, but he mm-hmm. basically says, you know, we can choose not to live in fear and not to let, you know, to quote again, not to let the momentary influences that surround us change who we are and how we behave. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just like, you know, even though things may be out of your control, you ultimately have control of your mental state. And I think that's
yes.
what he's really saying. You
yes.
know,
and
I mean, we can choose how to react to our surroundings.
To an extent, I think the initial response for everyone is to see, you know, potentially damaging changes as a threat. I mean, to get back to biology, it's just an evolved response, but obviously we do, like, beyond that, have control. It's just kind of like our primary appraisal is to be threatened, and, you know, for good reason. But at the same time, like you said, it ultimately lies in our hands.
Yeah.
So.
And that, you know, that's just, you know, the reason I bring that up is just because it coincides with the, you know, what we're talking about here in terms
mm-hmm.
of, you know, the kind of depression or the level or degree of depression that is, you know, that is sort of fixable, you know,
right.
by something like, you know, meditation, mindfulness, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, just, it's something to put into perspective, you know, your mental, your mental state.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes something that is just, it comes down to something as simple as just changing your attitude. I mean, we all heard that from the motivational speakers in middle school when none of us wanted to hear it, but, you know, for the lowest levels of depression, and that's what the most common types are, it's really just about kind of putting things into perspective, like you said, so.
It's interesting, though, because with something like the economy and, like, what Nick said about not taking responsibility, I think it's so easy to focus on things that are out of our control. I mean, it's easier mm-hmm. to do that than say focus what's on what is in your control, because then you have a responsibility to do something about it. So if I sit back and say, the economy blows and I'm just going to be screwed and I have a bunch of debt, and then, you know, like it allows you to be passive and it allows you to not engage and move forward and try to move beyond your own, you know, your depression or your anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, it instills a sense of hopelessness into us, you know, that we're supposed to fight. So,
yeah.
So on the other hand, you know, obviously there can be all these things that sort of, you know, lead to a depressive type state. But, you know, when you're thinking about ways to sort of combat that and going back to, like, you know, how you're viewing things and your mental attitude and everything else, like, something that I also thought of is just having, like, a support system or having, like, a group of people that you can go to and you know, just talk to about things, you know, whether they're friends or whether it's, like, a school group, you know, whatever it is, you know, just having that, like, constant group of people to go to and, you know, talk to or, you know, get inspiration or motivation from, you know, feeding off of each other. I think that people can do that for people. So does
Absolutely.
Anybody agree or...
Oh, yeah, that is hugely helpful, both in my own experience and, like, research. And interestingly, just on a, kind of a tangent, but still pretty related, Marr and Peterson, I think they are based in Yale, and they just recently came out with a study called The Benefits of Writing. And it looked at a group of people who were fired from their jobs for no reason or who had lost a family member, and they had them all journal for a year. Half of them, they had journal about just their daily acts, you know, like, today I got up, I had oatmeal for breakfast, and then I watched TV. But the other half, they had write about how they were feeling, how they were attempting to cope with the injustices that had just been done to them. And they found out after that year that the half of the people who had written about how they were feeling and attempting to cope, I mean, they felt way better, and they were less depressed, and they were actually healthier after a year, which shows the physical effects of kind of a mental problem. And they also had new jobs. And they had done studies beforehand looking at just what you had said, you know, just talking about it with someone, not even necessarily a trained professional, but talking about things, writing, both really help.
Okay, and what you just mentioned about actually confronting your emotions and actually journaling about your emotions and not just all the boring stuff that you do day to day. That also has to do with mindfulness. That's really mm-hmm. important to be aware of how you're feeling and confront it and embrace it and not just say, like, I feel bad, so I'm just going to ignore that feeling. Noticing when you feel bad and noticing when you feel happy, that's really crucial to overcoming obstacles, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
All right, well, kind of lost my train of thought there, so why don't one of you guys take the reins?
Well, all I was going to say is that, you know, going in line with the journaling aspect, which I think is really interesting, and I really am not surprised by that at all, because I've heard from other sources as well that things like having a journal, you know, to write things like that down in, you know, specifically I've heard of, like, Talben Shahar in his book Happier, he mentions, I think it's Talben Shahar, he mentions having, like, a journal where you write down, like, the things that you're grateful for, And, you know, like I think he said he has a ritual that every night, you know, he thinks about all the things that he's grateful for that he has, you know, because obviously there are always some, you know, someone who is less fortunate than us. And so he practices, you know, this, like, exercise of writing in a gratitude journal. And for whatever, you know, whatever reason, it just sort of reminds you. There's something about, like, putting it on paper that, I don't know, maybe actualizes it or makes it more concrete.
Yeah. Not necessarily the putting it on paper because, you know, it also works for talking, but I think it's, I kind of alluded to this before, it's that whole it's no longer mysterious to you, you know, it's no longer just some strange, ununderstandable cause, you know, some force behind you that's just controlling you. You know, when you put it in perspective, either by saying it or seeing it in front of you, it really, I don't know, makes a difference. You feel more empowered and in control, which is really what it's about, I think.
Yeah, and I actually have a clip from the podcast that talked about mindfulness meditation, a very short clip. It's just actually a quote. I'm going to try to get it to play if you guys want to bear with me for a second.
Okay, sure.
See if I can get it to work.
Is that working out there for you?
When people become more aware of their habitual styles of thinking, it's a habit almost that they've developed over time, they can learn to become aware of that, not judge it as good or bad, but just almost with a sense of curiosity, is almost like I said before, as if they're noticing it for the very first time and say, oh, catastrophizing is happening right now. As soon as they notice that, they stepped outside of it. It's no longer controlling them.
That was the voice of...
So, yeah, that was the clip. Did that sound okay to you guys? Or?
Yeah, that was fine. I'd agree with that, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going back to, you know, like you just said, Amanda, you know, it just makes it not... It demystifies it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of, like, I don't know, there's something about getting it out, you know. It's like, okay, now I know, and now that I'm aware of it, you know, it's like that self-awareness practice, you know, of mindfulness, and you know, it just does something for you, and it's just like, at least you can look at it and realize what it is, and, you know, then choose what you want to do with it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about that, and there's little to argue with that, you know. It's just something that's so almost... It's so strangely simple, but I think we can all agree with it, and we all kind of reached the same conclusion independently. So,
yeah, definitely clear and distinct. And one of the things that I was thinking about is just, or I do think about often, is just that, you know, life is based on contingencies. We often say to each other, oh, I'll talk to you later, you know, I'll see you later, or I'll do that tomorrow. And the fact is that we don't know that we have that, and there is this great amount, if not, and you know, the entire amount minus what we can control in our own brains, that life's based on contingencies. You know, you could die tomorrow, and you could, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And so I think definitely, like, this just goes right along with what we're saying. It's about the acceptance of that, and being able to understand and know that that's okay, and you know, seize the day.
Right. And I know we had talked about anxiety before. It's kind of that same, like, hesitancy to accept those contingencies. You know, it's, you know, I don't want this to happen. So instead of being willing or allowing themselves to actually live, you know, in the moment or freely at all, they just kind of close themselves off. So I don't know. It's tough.
I think a really important part of why people feel a sense of hopelessness or depression has to do with the fact that we don't have a lot of things in our lives that we just enjoy doing just for the sake of doing them. I think we've talked about these activities before, self-concordant activities.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'd have to agree with the recent literature on it that
it is necessary to have a self-concordant activity, which is just something that you just do for the sake of doing it. And you just love to do this activity. And I think that everybody needs to have that to combat these feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the key is to really surround yourself with, I mean, like that positive imagery. And I mean, that promotes positive thinking. I mean, it's like a chain reaction.
And we have another caller, so we're going to take that now.
Oh.
Hello?
Hello, caller?
Hello.
Hi.
Would you like to announce yourself or remain anonymous?
I'll remain anonymous.
Okay, do you have a question?
It's just sort of a follow-up point, going back to the clip that was played. You know, when you perceive or conceive or whatever, but you look at the emotional experience like almost like you're observing it rather than being a victim to it. And I just wanted to ask Amanda, the psychology major, because she about this, because at one point you said, I think the whole thing is about being in control. Did you say that?
Yeah, feeling like you can, yeah, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to, I totally agree with that. And I wanted to connect that point with the clip that the other Amanda played. And I've just started reading about, like, neuroscience, and I think you referred to it as, like, biological psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And are you familiar with the concept of executive function?
Yes.
Okay. And as I understand that, he mentioned the frontal lobes, and that is an activity of the frontal lobes, correct?
Yeah.
And it's really, and you also mentioned that this is the part of the brain that develops last, that this is still developing into one's early 20s. And as I understand it, that's the part of the brain that is really the locus of the, I call it, and I'm not the only one who calls it this, but the self-regulative capacities.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this whole idea of self-regulation, which is, as I understand it, really the fundamental ability involved in goal-directed behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going back to the clip that Amanda played, like, it seems to me that it's that part of the brain when, you know, you actually are at the point where you can recognize an emotional state happening to you, and you're recognizing it because you know that if you don't, it's bad. Like, you do it so you can get control over it. So you're, like, at that point, there's something else controlling whatever the consciousness or the field of consciousness that a person is. And I just wanted to connect the two. It's not really a question, but I just saw a connection there between, you know, an earlier claim that you made about control and this thing about the emotion. And I think I'll just hang up unless anybody has...
Well, I just want to say that was super insightful and awesome because I hadn't even thought of that. But now once you say that, I'm thinking, wow, this is, you know, the part of the brain that develops last. And, you know, coping for depression, drugs and alcohol are most commonly used for the youngest people suffering from depression. Mm-hmm. And we all know that drugs and alcohol, you know, kind of affect or impair the frontal lobe, you know, so all these goal-directed functions. So it's just so interesting how it all...
And I also think and I highly recommend, it's a book called, I think, Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain or something, and it's a book that basically puts in very easy to understand language, but like going back, because you guys have been talking about a distinction between like cognitive behavioral therapy and like using the analytic part of one's brain to deal with depression versus other, you know, other approaches. And, you know, just to connect with neuroscience, what a sort of repeated analytic approach does, like cognitive behavioral therapy and developing those sorts of habits of thought, it's actually, you know, affecting the brain. Like, it's not just this abstract thing that's happening. And
And I just think, you know, both, it's one, like drugs and alcohol, we think, oh, that affects the body because it's affecting, I don't know, certain more primitive systems. But it's also the case that the abstract cognitive operations are also embodied. And anyway, I just wanted to make that point. And I also wanted to just give it up for Aristotle, who recognized all of this over 2,000 years ago. So, but anyway, finally we're coming back to it. It took us a while to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, thanks. Great clip, great show, and I'm going to hang up.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
That was awesome.
That was awesome. That was really insightful.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about, I guess, just to mention briefly, how young people use substances to cope with these feelings. And I think that one thing that we should mention is that there are healthy ways to cope that I think we should discuss a little bit more here.
Right.
What are some of the healthy ways that you can think of, Amanda? Because I have a couple that I can think of, but I'd like to hear from you.
In terms of, like, lower levels, like, separate from, like, professional therapy and drugs?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just, you know, when you get that sense of anxiety, like, let's say you're feeling anxious because of a social situation or because an exam is coming up, or you're feeling depressed because you did poorly on something you thought you were going to do well on, you know, just things, mm-hmm. everyday situations that just make us feel bad. What do you have for tips for coping with those types of things?
Well, let's see. Personally, I try to just kind of direct my attention elsewhere because I know that I'm probably just feeling bad kind of in the moment, and that logically when I take a step back, I don't know. I guess, yeah, that's what I can emphasize. Just try to take a step back, put it into perspective, use your intelligence at this point over whatever more base part of your brain is reacting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just anything. It really varies on the person. I like dancing around in my room, and other people like to go for a run, which is probably, you know, a better channel, but, you know, whatever works for us. I don't know. I think, yeah, and it's kind of a shame because, you know, in the college setting, the easiest, kind of most fun, you know, socially advantageous option is to, you know, go to a party and, like, pass out. But I don't know. I guess that works kind of for the night, but the next day and further, it won't pay off.
Yeah, you'll still have those emotions.
Mm-hmm. It's not really learning to cope at all. And I mean, yeah, taking a step back works, but I mean, for, like you said, day-to-day things, whatever temporary solution you can come up with, I would advocate.
All right, and I think that we mentioned a good support system earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's necessary, too. Not just having a support system, but having a support system that encourages healthy coping mechanisms.
Right. Not just someone who will kind of sap up your negative energy, but who will kind of, yeah, help you deal with it and see things in a different light. I agree.
And to add to that, as far as, like, the support systems, you know, for people that maybe their friends aren't even the best support systems at sometimes, and so maybe, you know, it's even helpful to seek out other forms of support, you know, for example,
mm-hmm.
school groups or something. Sometimes those can be really helpful, too, because, you know, when you have somebody else to talk to about, you know, or someone who's in the same class and is experiencing the same, you know, stress or anxiety about their grades or whatever else, you know, someone to share tips with about, you know, hey, how are you dealing? Because it just seems like those are the things that are really, really helpful on a daily basis.
Right. Having someone with whom to commiserate doesn't sound the best, but, I mean, it's absolutely helpful. I mean, oftentimes some of the best friendships are forged over a common, I don't want to say enemy necessarily, but a friend of mine will definitely attest to just, you know, yeah, like you said, having someone that just understands what you're going through on whatever level.
Really. We've been Sorry, go ahead, Amanda.
Just to connect that to the previous episode of the law school episode where Jordan and Chris were interviewed, I remember one of them was talking about how, you know, it was really helpful for them to get through, like, exams, for example, because, you know, all those kids in their class everybody was going through the same thing, and so to have that really just made going through the exams a much easier process to deal with.
Yeah, going through stressful experiences with someone really facilitates bonding. I mean, that's been proven, so.
Which is probably why they always say that college friends are lifelong friends, right?
Yeah.
Wow, that really brings us full circle.
I was just going to mention that we talked a little bit about short-term solutions, but I want to give it up for long-term solutions because I think for myself those have really been the beneficial ones in dealing with the anxiety of school things. And I think it deals primarily with investing in something, and I think a lot of creative endeavors kind of are like this, or even if it's like reading a long novel. I mean, it's just, when you're invested in something, you really come to grips with the idea that, you know, everything is there's something bigger going on, and it's important to kind of put yourself in accordance with that and realize that and dealing with anxiety, and that these little things are really just little things.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why religion is a great way for people to, you know, are two of us talking at once?
No, just you.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that's why religion is a really good, not necessarily escape, but like support system for people, because, I don't know, like you just mentioned, it makes them feel more connected to a whole, and like there is some greater reason for living, being. So.
Right, and that makes me think, Sandra and I are in a class, Death and Dying, and we talk about,
yeah,
like, how people need to have meaningful things in their
right.
life.
Yeah, Robert J. Lifton in Living and Dying talks about that. He talks about death anxiety and how we need to promote life imagery to kind of deal with the death anxiety that everyone has to deal with at some point or another. And he talks about creative things.
Okay.
And he talks about even like investing in family and seeing something that's bigger than yourself and investing in that. And that's, I mean, it's just really, it's a great book if you ever get a chance to read it.
Definitely.
What was the name of that book again, Sandra?
Living and Dying, Robert J. Lifton. He's a psychiatrist.
With that said, I just to answer the question, you know, if there's any other resources, you know, as far as like podcasts, books, websites, can anybody think of any other resources like that to mention? I know the podcast, if anybody's interested, it was, we actually have a link to that website. Does anybody want to announce the website?
I don't know off the top of my head.
We'll get back to you on
we'll
that.
We'll get back to you.
Okay. Well, just to note, in the future, we have a website in the works, so we'll be announcing the name of that website, and we'll be including the links to all these additional resources that we have on the website as a way to sort of interact with our listeners and as sort of a supplement to our discussions.
And, yeah, if you guys want me to give you links to those articles that I've been referencing also, I can get those to you.
Yeah, that would be great. We'll post those on the website, too. Just right off the top of my head, I can think of a couple of podcasts that I thought were really helpful in, just inspirational to me. One of them is from Stanford University. And it's called Your Body on the Line, and I think that I've raved to you guys about it. It's about Julia Butterfly Hill, who was the woman who climbed up a tree and stayed there for 2 years. I'm sure you guys remember that. And she talks about how just finding a passion for something can make your life feel a little bit more meaningful, and being a part of something as a whole can make your life feel a little bit more worthwhile, I guess. I thought that was really helpful and really interesting to consider. It's not really focused on depression, but you can definitely see the ties if you're having a rough day and you just think about how things are meaningless, and then you listen to someone who did something like that. I think it's really empowering. So.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, just a lot of people
who suffer from depression are kind of facing, like, existential crises. So it's, yeah, really nice to feel a part of something like, I don't know, a church that I've frequented, UU. They talk about an interdependent web of existence and how we're all a part of that. And it's just kind of a nice kind of, you know, fresh look on things that really plays to what we all feel. You know, we all on some level want to be connected to the world around us and everyone with whom we share it. So,
yeah, kind of a humorous spin on existentialism is I Heart Huckabees, and he talks about the blanket concept. And it's kind of similar to that interconnectedness. If you were to imagine the universe on a blanket and how we're all, he points to different parts and he goes, you're here, but this is you too, you know, and it kind of just shows that that thing you were talking about. Also, to mention a book, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. I think he's actually the founder of existential psychology, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
But I've heard great things about the book. Have not read it myself.
It's a great book.
Also, To End All Wars by Thomas Gordon, I think. Ernest Gordon is who it's written by, and it's really great. Check that out if you're interested. We also have the website link. It's www.ethelo.com/ethicstalk, and that is our website. So if you are interested in checking that out, that is up.
And I believe the link for the podcast that I played the clip from is actually already on the website. So if anybody's interested in listening to the full podcast, I believe the link is on the website.
Well, great. We have about 3 minutes left. So I guess I just want to thank you, Amanda, for calling in.
You've been really helpful
in explaining all this stuff to us.
Yes, thank you.
I have a quick question that I actually wanted to ask you at the beginning, Amanda. Was there like a specific instance or a situation or experience you had that really brought you to psychology and brought you to studying it or made you want to pursue this?
It's the only thing I think I'm naturally good at. I mean, you know, I can be taught things and pick things up, but I don't know, I was actually kind of left it just by default. I was thinking maybe journalism, but I had a terrible experience with that my first semester of my freshman year. You know, maybe political science, but, you know, as we age, we all get more cynical, sadly. And I don't know, psychology just kind of remained on the list. And then I realized that I had been lucky enough to pick the school with the best psychology department in the country. So
I took a class
and loved it. So
good deal.
Yeah, and I guess I'm gonna praise you a little bit, Amanda. You and I have been friends for, like, years now. And you are amazing at just stepping outside of yourself and seeing the flaws of the system and just kind of dissecting things. So you'll be a great psychologist.
Oh, thank you. Thank you guys for hosting me.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, call in again.
Will do.
Definitely. Your opinion is always welcome.
Thank you.
And I just want to briefly say for any Central Michigan students that are listening out there that feel like you need an extra resource here on campus, we have a great counseling program here in Faust, and their website is on the portal, so you should check that out if you're feeling like you need a little extra something. And I know there's support groups all over campus for whatever you might be going through. I have everywhere. Just a little plug for our counseling center here.
All right. Well, thanks for
listening. And also we should probably plug our website a little more, too. On the website, in attempts to get the listeners, whoever is listening, to interact with the radio show, you know, we have a spot that you can send in suggestions and comments about future radio show topics. So if you have something that you think is really interesting that we should talk about, maybe you could go ahead and make those suggestions on the website. And does anybody else want to add to that?
Yeah, definitely. We want to hear from all of our listeners. So,
if there's like a movie or a book or anything that you think would be good inspiration for a conversation, we'd be interested.
All right. Well, thanks again, Amanda.
Yeah.
Check us out next week.
We'll post details about next week's show. So.
And I'll just end with a real quick Winston Churchill quote. A pessimist will find difficulty in every opportunity, whereas an optimist will find opportunity in every difficulty.
All right. Thank you. See you next week.
Yep. Bye.